This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Massachusetts students have consistently ranked fairly high on national and international tests. The latest out today, the Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA, again has Massachusetts doing pretty well. The state's 15-year-olds had the fourth best scores in reading, behind Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Singapore. And Massachusetts was sixth in science and 10th in math, finishing behind countries like Finland, South Korea, and Switzerland. State education officials and Governor Deval Patrick say the results offer reason to be proud. And when you consider that Massachusetts students did a lot better than American students overall, who finished in the middle of the pack in reading and science and well below average in math, maybe they're right. But we wonder, what do these test scores really tell us about our education system here in Massachusetts and across the nation? To help us with those questions, we're joined by Paul Revel. He's the former Massachusetts Secretary of Education. He now teaches education policy and administration at Harvard, from where he joins us now. And Paul Revel, thank you for joining us. Good to have you back on Radio Boston.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us from Washington, D.C. is Mark Schneider. He's a fellow at the American Institutes for Research and the former commissioner of the National Center for Education Statistics. He knows a lot about these kinds of tests and what they mean. And Mark Schneider, welcome to Radio Boston.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And listeners, we want you in on this conversation. What do you think these international test results tell us about our education system here in Massachusetts or across the nation? What don't they tell us? And what, if anything, do they suggest that we might be able to learn from higher achieving students from other countries like Korea, like Finland, like Estonia? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Paul Revel, I'd like to start with you. Your former boss, Governor Patrick, said today that these tests should make us proud. Is that your take? Do you agree with that?
Oh, I absolutely agree with the governor on that. This is validation for a 20-year education reform effort that has been strong and thoughtful in Massachusetts. So we have a lot to be proud of. But as always, when we look at these results are based on averages. And if you dig down within those averages, you see significant achievement gaps and areas where we have to improve. But I take it on the whole as a validation of the kind of strategy that Massachusetts has pursued over two decades now of having high standards, well-designed, challenging tests, real accountability, and real support for students and schools. And this has made a difference. It's moved us from the middle of the pack to the front of the pack. We've got a lot more work to be done, but it's time to take a bow as far as this goes and then move on to focus on closing those achievement gaps.
All right. So we'll take a bow for now. But if we, as you said, let's dig down a little bit. So 15-year-olds came in fourth in reading behind Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Singapore. They were seventh in science behind a bunch of countries, including Finland and Estonia. They were 10th in math behind Korea, Liechtenstein, Switzerland, and among other countries. So we're number four, we're number seven, we're number 10. Are we trumping these scores just a little too much? I mean, shouldn't we be striving to be better than Finland, better than Liechtenstein, better than Estonia, and so on?
Well, I think our goal should be to do as well as we possibly can and to outperform our competitors no matter where they are. At the same time, you raise the question, well, what is there to be learned from these other locations? And other locations have different factors. For example, if we bear down on these statistics, we see poverty is a huge factor in determining achievement. We know that here in Massachusetts. There's an iron law correlation between socioeconomic status and educational achievement and attainment. These scores bear that out once again. Many of these other jurisdictions that have outperformed Massachusetts have done much better at securing housing, health care, mental health services, things of this nature to intervene and mitigate some of the negative effects of poverty that get in the way of students achieving at high levels. So there are factors like that. There are educational factors. Some of these countries do a much stronger job than we do of building a sustaining, gratifying teaching profession. Others of them do much better on applied learning and career readiness. So we do have things both educationally to learn from them and in terms of the social economic background of our students and what we need to do to mitigate factors of poverty that get in the way of many of our students achieving at high levels.
I'm glad you brought up the issue of poverty because I wanted to focus on that during this conversation. But let me come quickly to Mark Schneider and just get, Mark, your quick take on your view of these results. And then I wanted to ask you about sort of the overall value of these tests. But first of all, what jumps out at you at these latest results?
So the first thing is when we start ranking Massachusetts versus other states, that's technically not correct because there are margins of error around these scores. This is based on a sample. So when you say Massachusetts is fourth or eighth or 12th, it actually it's not correct. So just to put a little blanket on that party, or whatever the right metaphor is, the fact of the matter is that you're really high and you should be congratulated for that. But when we start saying you're fourth, that's actually not correct because the standard error, the margin of error around everybody's scores makes them indistinguishable. I know we love to do it. I do it all the time also. But we just want to be careful about that. Mm. You outperformed the United States. You outperformed many other countries. That's true. But to say you were fourth is really not technically correct. So the second thing, and this is a thing actually that I think is really important and was just alluded to in the previous comments, and that is that the PISA scores are not in themselves telling you anything new. The fact of the matter is that when I was at NCS, we administered the NAEP assessments as well as PISA and TIMSS, and Massachusetts for 20 years has gotten its act together and has done everything, pretty close to everything right. And so, yes, you are the model for the country, for the United States in terms of getting things done right and having a strong commitment to an agenda, a policy agenda to reforms that actually has proven to be the correct one. So one of the things that I really do want to warn about is that OECD is not only administering an assessment, but its reports are filled with policy advice and policy implications, many of which I find not to be based in evidence and not to be credible.
Mark, just for our listeners, I want to just say OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is a European-based organization that administers the test, right?
That is correct.
Yeah,
that is correct.
Go ahead.
So that is correct. And they actually have many policy biases and many policy beliefs that they use when interpreting the results.
Such as, give us an example of the kind of policy bias that they have.
So a couple of years ago, it was all about school autonomy. School autonomy was good because of this or that. And right now, it's preschool. So there's evidence. And the evidence, I believe that preschool really matters, but PISA doesn't tell us this. And now all of a sudden they're talking about the importance of rigorous standards and how PISA validates the movement to the Common Core. Again, I don't, this is all a stretch. But the kinds of things that Paul mentioned earlier, that things that you have done are absolutely correct. You know, we need to have high standards. We need to be very careful about enforcing those standards. We need to be careful but aggressive about weeding out bad teachers, rewarding good teachers, taking teachers in the middle, and incentivizing them to be better. I believe that we need to improve school choice, for example. But what's the evidence on that? It's sort of mixed. But the fact of the matter is that you've done a lot of things that are correct, and you should be applauded for that.
Mm. I'm wondering, Mark Schneider, I'll just stick with you, just to pick up on Paul Revel's point about poverty, because, this is a point that's been picked up on by a number of people looking at these results who say that, the U.S., now I'm sort of talking about the U.S. performance overall, which is like mired in the middle. Arnie Duncan referred to the results as a picture of educational stagnation, the Secretary of Education. And one of the main reasons that folks point to is because the U.S. needs to do more to address the effects of poverty on education. Do you agree with that?
So there is a high correlation between poverty and test performance. There's no question about it. What I get worried about when we start talking about that is that poverty becomes an excuse.
Hmm.
Right. There are schools, clearly there are schools that break the pattern. There are teachers that break the relationship. I don't believe that we should just sort of say, oh, we're just mediocre because we have high rates of poverty, which, by the way, our rates of poverty are pretty much in line with a lot of other OECD countries. So I get very nervous when I hear people talking about this iron law of poverty. It's a very strong factor. There's no question about it. But we can't use it as an excuse.
Paul Revel, is there a danger that we use it as an excuse?
Oh, absolutely. I think the danger is that we say, well, it's all about socioeconomic background and schools don't make a difference. And we know in individual instances that schools do make a difference. What we haven't been able to do is to take some of those schools that are at the margin, at the high end of the distribution, and scale them up at even the level of a city that has high levels of poverty. And when you look at some of the highest performing jurisdictions, places like Singapore and Finland, who we're constantly being compared to, you can't ignore the fact that their poverty rates are half or a third of what the poverty rates are in the United States. So it's not an excuse. Socioeconomic status is not destiny for any individual, but overall, it would be foolish to ignore that poverty is a factor that often gets in the way of students achieving at high levels. Mm.
Listeners, we're talking about the latest international test results that show Massachusetts doing pretty well relative to a bunch of other European countries and the rest of the U.S., actually the rest of the world. But what do you think these international tests really tell us about our education system here in the States or across the nation? What don't they tell us? And what do they suggest that we might learn from higher achieving students from other countries? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go to Mary, who's calling from Andover. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. You've already addressed my first concern about poverty, and your guest gave such a well-balanced answers. I appreciate it. There's another issue that's not being addressed by these tests, and it's the social culture in which our students live. They have so many demands on their time that it's difficult for them to be good at any one particular thing because they have to be good at 1,000 different things, especially if they're caught up in the have-to-get-into-the-right-college racket, which is what I call it. And quite honestly, I also think another issue is that we're asking schools to do too much. Their counseling centers now, their social clubs, their sports clubs, and not that any of those things aren't important, they are, but what is the main function of a school? I think these are conversations that aren't happening, the social culture they live in and then everything schools are being asked to do.
Well, Mary, it's a big set of issues. I'm glad you put it on the table. Paul Revel, do you want to respond to Mary's point about this, about the issue that's not being discussed, the students' social culture and the way schools have to respond to that?
Well, I think there are a lot of issues with respect to social culture. One issue is inequality. Some kids have way too many demands for the amount of time available. Other kids have very little, if anything, to do in the 80% of their lives that they spend, the 80% of their waking hours that they spend outside of school. So I think one of the issues in our school system is that it's a one-size-fits-all type of system, and we haven't differentiated as much as we need to do to have a system that meets every kid where he or she is and gives them what they need in order to be successful. And that's different in Lawrence, for example, than it is in Andover, and we need a system with some flexibility to take that into account. We're not looking to educate a generation of specialists in the K-12 system. Hmm. Children should be broad. They should have a variety of competencies that they develop. And yet at the same time, if we're going to have all kids do comparably well in school and perform at high levels, we need to be sure that every child has access to the learning and educational opportunities that exist for affluent children outside of school.
But I'm really curious, sort of to pick up on Mary's point, and Mark, I'll come to you. I mean, when we look at some of these foreign countries, for example, aren't their systems a little more focused earlier on in a kid's academic career? I mean, I know that takes place in some European systems, for example. Might that have something to do with the way kids, the test results that these kids get?
Well, okay. I actually have a very good friend who lives in Korea, and I've actually lived with his family for 3 weeks. I've seen him many times, but I actually lived with him for 3 weeks. And his I want to go back to the social cultural demands on children. His daughter, she was about 12 or 13 years old at the time, started her day at 6:30 in the morning. She did martial arts, then music, then went to school, then went to cram school, you know, advanced training in, it was English cram school, then did music, and came home and did homework. Her day went from about 6:30 in the morning to about 10 o'clock at night, every day. I mean, so this was an of course, this was an upper, a very highly educated, upper middle class family. But the pressures, the social demands that were being placed on this young woman was really way in excess of anything that I ever put on my daughters, who were, turned out to be pretty high achievers. But I mean, it was just a totally different kind of demand system put on children. And I think we've made a choice not to do that, quite frankly. I mean, even though we worry about the demands we're putting on our children and on ourselves by, you know, driving your 12-year-old kid to soccer games and music and all this kind of stuff, what I saw in her school and what I saw in her life was, you know, makes us look like pikers.
of course, let me just jump in there because and jump over to Paul Revel, because Mark Schneider is reminding me of a conversation, a debate that we're hearing a lot about right now for a longer school day. I mean, is there anything in these tests to suggest that U.S. results might be better if we adopted longer school days across the board?
Well, as has been said earlier, we're asking more of schools now than we've ever asked of them before. We're asking them to get not just some students to a high level of performance, but to get all students to a high level of performance, not only in sort of the core subjects that we test, like reading and math and science, but in a range of subjects and including, you know, important skills that employers are asking for, like communication skills, capacity to cooperate, speak foreign languages, be aware of other cultures, things of this nature. And we're asking them all to do it on essentially the same structure that we inherited from the early 20th century. You know, 6 hours a day, 180 days a year is roughly standard. That amounts to 20% of a child's waking hours during the ages kindergarten to 12. And it just isn't enough for everything that we're asking schools to do. So I think there's no question that there are many more things that we'd like to do in school, that getting everybody to a high standard of performance in English, math, and science is taking way more time than it was to get a few people to a high standard. So we've run out of time in schools, and we're not giving the kind of well-balanced education that we'd like to give to our children. There has, in fact, been a narrowing of the curriculum. And the only solve for this would be to make expanded learning time available, especially to those who are caught in achievement gaps.
Mm. Let's go to Dean, who's calling from Brookline. Hi, Dean. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I'm just wondering whether or not any of these test results include scores coming out of private schools, because I suspect if they're not included, then we're getting a sort of an inaccurate representation of American children test-taking abilities, at least.
Interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. Do you, Mark Schneider?
No, actually, I'm trying to think if PISA includes private schools. I think that there's a good – if we look at other test assessments like NAEP that does have private schools, the statement is correct, and that is that private schools tend to have higher scores on NAEP, for example, than public schools. And a lot of this is not necessarily that they're delivering – necessarily a better education, though many people argue that. It's that there's a self-selection process going on that many high-achieving students end up in private schools.
Hmm.
I don't know the answer about PISA. I think we could find it, but I don't know it offhand.
All right. Well,
my understanding of the sample in Massachusetts is that it's exclusively public schools.
Exclusively public. Okay, good. And we can confirm that for you, Dean. We've got a producer working on that right now. Let's go to Nick, who's calling from Wayland. Hey, Nick, you're on the air.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for your guest. I was just wondering if there's any concern about Massachusetts adopting the Common Core standards, which by every account are quite good, but considering Massachusetts has really some of the best scores in the entire nation, there's also a lot of concern that we'll be killing the golden goose, and if anything, our scores will go down by adopting a set of weaker standards than we already have in place. Thank you.
Paul Revel, sounds like a good question for you.
Yes, it would be a good question for me. I was Secretary of Education and took a vote on the Board of Education to embrace the Common Core standards. Common Core standards were actually heavily patterned on Massachusetts. In fact, the Board of Education reviewed a variety of studies that showed a degree of overlap with the Common Core standards and the Massachusetts standards at about a level of 90 to 95%. So those standards are substantially the same as ours, not coincidentally, because we in Massachusetts told the framers of the Common Core standards that we would not adopt them unless they were at least as rigorous or more rigorous than our own. And by the time we made our final decision to adopt the Common Core standards, we were convinced that they would, in fact, stretch beyond what we were already expecting and were better aligned with what colleges and employers wanted our students to be competent at. So we took that vote. I think that in the near term, many states are going to experience, as we've seen in New York, a substantial drop in their scores. I don't think Massachusetts is going to see a substantial drop, but insofar as the standards are somewhat higher, it wouldn't be surprising to see test scores be somewhat lower against the new standards. But I don't think that's a reason not to embrace a higher standard, particularly if that higher standard is well aligned with what our employers and what our college faculty want to see and well aligned with international benchmarks in these nations with whom we're competing.
Let's go to John, who's calling from Jamaica Plain. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm both a parent and a teacher, and I just want to say that, first of all, the scores are not mired. We've never been at the top of this particular test. But more importantly, I think this shows that our inability to move up is because of all of the high-stakes testing. We have so much testing among our students right now, almost 6 weeks out of the school year, that, you know, when you're talking about say needing more time. Maybe if we had fewer high-stakes tests, maybe if we stopped testing kindergartners, we would have more time to actually teach students.
It's an interesting point, John. I'd love to get this on the table for conversation. You know, I'll come to you, Mark Schneider, on this one. I was doing some reading about the response to these test results today. The American Federation of Teachers blamed the mediocre test scores nationally on an overemphasis on standardized tests. And the union pointed out that none of the top-tier countries place such an emphasis on testing like the U.S. does. I don't know if that's true, but do you agree with that?
Well, okay. So, no, I don't agree with that at all. And I don't think, so let me go back to the first premise. And that is, I agree, that the school year is too short. I agree that the school day is too short. And actually, we do have to get away from a model that we inherited from an agrarian society into one in which, we need to spend more time on students and more, giving them more opportunities to learn. There's no question about that. There is absolutely no substitute for time on task. There's no substitute for that. End of story on that one. The second reason that I, quite frankly, that I believe that the emphasis on standard testing cannot go away is because, quite frankly, and I'm going to quote Arnie Duncan, the Secretary of Education, on this, when we don't have standardized tests that are held to Common Core standards or the wonderful standards that Massachusetts developed, the fact of the matter is that high schools, school systems lie. I mean, they lie by giving terrible tests and by giving tests that are not benchmarked, that are not standard, held to any Common Core standards, to any standards at all. So when New York all of a sudden goes to a much more rigorous test, that's a much more accurate description and reflection of what we need and what we want from our schools, the test scores go down. And this happens over and over again because we need to have higher standards and higher accountability. And right now, the only way we know how to do this is with good tests, good standardized tests that are actually fundamentally reflecting the wants and the needs of our society.
Well, Paul Revel, the MCAS has a pretty good reputation nationally, but respond to caller John's concern that even so, too much time spent testing.
Well, I think the No Child Left Behind Act instituted a lot of testing in every year from third through ninth grade. I appreciate what I hear from many teachers and some students, that there's too much time spent on testing. At the same time, having said that, testing is just a yardstick. It's not an educational device in itself. It's a chance done well, and I think we've done it well in Massachusetts by having open-ended, thoughtful kinds of tests. Testing is a chance to demonstrate mastery. And I think we absolutely have to keep score, if you will. We have to keep track of student performance, or we have no hope of achieving our goals. So I make no apology for testing. Can we be more efficient about the way in which we do it? Can we perhaps consume less time in a student's educational career in doing it? Absolutely. But at the same time, it would be a mistake to act as though measuring progress is somehow a mistake or a waste of time in the educational context. Demonstrating what you know and are able to do is, in fact, an educational process in itself.
Mm. Absolutely.
I think we're going to end it there. I want to just bring this fact up. It was a question raised by a caller a few minutes back about who took the test. We did have a producer look into this. According to the Washington Post, around 500,000 15-year-olds from public and private schools took the PISA exam in 2012. So I just wanted to put that fact out there, that according to the Washington Post. But that's it. Our time is up. Paul Revel, former Massachusetts Secretary of Education. He now teaches education policy and administration at Harvard. Thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating conversation. Really appreciated your input.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me with you.
And Mark Schneider, he's a fellow at the American Institute for Research and the former commissioner of the National Center for Education Statistics. Mark Schneider, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, America's first sports hero bare-knuckled his way to the top from the streets of Boston's South End. Stick with us. Fascinating story about the Boston Strong Boy. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.